Good afternoon, you're tuned in to a Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, the 24th of June, the year 2015. Jeff Brown with you here. Today we'll continue our series, Words 101, with poets Emily Wall and Ishmael Hope. Tim Ortiz and Andrea Donahue will be here with an update on art classes at the campus. We'll learn about a Tai Chi for seniors class. We'll talk with Assistant Fire Chief Ed Quinto about summer fire safety. At Writer's Almanac, Burnout Music and more today on a Juno Afternoon. If you missed the live show, it's also available at 4 on KRNN and online at ktwo.org. Well, the forecast for tonight, likely with low temperatures 52 to 58 degrees with light winds. Forecast for Thursday, high temperatures around 63 degrees with rain. Friday, rain with high temperatures around 60 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. First Nations people living near British Columbia's Mount Polly Mine dam break continue to worry about its impact on traditional foods. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Jacinda Mack grew up fishing for sockeye salmon along British Columbia's Fraser River. She says it was a community and family event.
We would eat salmon eggs in the morning for breakfast. We would process all morning. We would hang salmon in the smokehouse. We would jar salmon. We would freeze it.
Mac of the Sequakum First Nation says that didn't happen last year.
The smokehouses were empty, the freezers were empty, the jars were empty, and it was really compared to a death.
No one fished because the grounds were downstream from the Mount Polly mine. A dam holding back rock, silt, and wastewater breached last August, spilling into nearby lakes and streams and eventually the Fraser River. Mac is the mining response coordinator for the Northern Shuswap Tribal Council. She says most in the area don't believe government and industry claims that damage was minimal and the salmon are largely safe. She also worries about larger impacts.
It was released into this ecosystem that is very precious within our territory, but that ripples out through the waterways to the rest of the world. It reaches the ocean.
The mine remains closed, but owners are working toward reopening. The same company just won approval for putting its Red Chris mine closer to the U.S. border into full production. For National Native News, I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A college student who's from the Pine Ridge Reservation has been selected as one of 58 recipients of the Harry S. Truman Scholarship. As Jim Kent reports, the accolade is the latest in a string of scholarships that have helped the young Oglala Lakota student pursue higher educational goals.
It was dedication and hard work that helped Keith Martinez do well at Little Wound School. His efforts eventually caught the attention of one of his teachers, who suggested Keith apply for the STEP program, an intensive college preparatory curriculum for talented youth that accepts one student each year. Recognized by STEP, Keith relocated to a host family in New York, where he attended Scarsdale High School and then Villanova University. Along the way, he picked up a Gates Millennium Scholarship and a Presidential Scholarship from Villanova. At the close of his junior year, Keith has now learned that he's one of a select few to become a Truman Scholar. Keith Martinez credits his success to his parents. He adds that having a strong support system is vital to youth everywhere, but especially on a reservation.
Whenever I feel like that support is gone, then I talk to one of them and they keep me going. I think that's the thing that a lot of youth lack in the schooling system or just in general on the reservation, and it causes a lot of potential to be lost.
The absence of that support system, Keith believes, is what causes all potential to be lost for many youth. Keith Martinez is currently studying communications and public relations. The $30,000 from the Truman Scholarship will help pay for graduate studies in public policy. Keith's ultimate goal is to return to Pine Ridge and change public policy in order to improve the lives of his people. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
U.S. North Dakota Senator John Hoeven announced Tuesday a grant to help veterans on the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. The $200,000 award is going to the tribe to provide job training and placement assistance to homeless veterans living on the reservation. The funds are from the Department of Labor's Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program. The Tanana Chiefs Conference is keeping an eye on several fires in interior Alaska. Its emergency response team is monitoring and coordinating with communities to address their safety needs. As of Tuesday, the Alaska Native organization was planning to send out food to those in need and help with evacuation efforts. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the law firm of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxby, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned in to Juno Afternoon here on listener-supported public media. In the studio with me now are Emily Wall and Ishmael Hope, two poets who are helping us out with Words 101 series. Ishmael and Emily, thank you very much for coming to the station.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeff. It's great to be here.
So we're doing this series called Words 101, and poetry is a series of words in itself. If you could possibly define a poem, what is a poem and what isn't a poem?
That's a big question right out of the gate right there. I think it's hard to define it because poems can look so many different ways. I think if I had to give it the like Jeopardy answer, I would say it's a short piece of writing with a high intensity of feeling. But it can look so different, so many different forms, so many different shapes, narrative poems, lyric poems. You know, it can really vary a lot. What do you think?
Well, I think poetry is a deep and intense thought. A poem is a deep and intense thought, and poetry, I agree with one of my mentors, Robert Bringhurst, who really thinks it's a property of being. It's everywhere. It's especially within nature, where it springs out in complete abundance. And so we tap into that just a little bit when we're able to have that deep and intense thought. To me, it's like meditation, and then it just unfolds and comes out. And you could do that within very versified, defined forms, learning the craft, but I think it needs some of that breath, that life breath, to really make it a poem.
Who are some notable poets in the past couple hundred years?
You know, I would say some Alaskan poets. We have some amazing poets in the state. Peggy Shoemaker, Joan Kane, Aaron Hollowell, Ishmael is one of my favorite poets, Christy Erickson. Mm-hmm. We have some incredible poets in the state that have been working. There was Tom Sexton just got a great review in the New York Times Book Review for his last book. So I would give a shout out to our home state poets.
I'm really influenced. We're talking about that last few centuries. I'm really influenced by Federico Garcia Lorca, Pablo Neruda, mm-hmm. and Antonio Machado. I like reading Robert Bly. He swings wildly between what's effective and what's not, I think, but he's really great. I love Richard Dauenhauer's work
yeah.
and Nora Dauenhauer's work. That's just that it's just such a gift to have had Richard here and have Nora. So those are some that come to mind. And Robert Bringhurst, his selected poems just came out in 2009. He really teaches me a way of thinking that taps into, you know, a deep part of my being.
What about a poem does that to you? Can you define what the poem does?
The thing that I relate it to is like when you're just getting up in the morning, and sometimes it's like you catch yourself waking up, and it's like you're looking at your identity from a distance, and you can even be confused about who you are, really, because you're just pure consciousness in some ways. Coming into your identity. And so I think that awareness of the world is constantly around us, but we kind of overlook it with the clutter, you know. And poetry, the clutter and the flutter and the fray can go into the poem, but it also has some of that that life and vitality.
Yeah, I would say we were just talking a minute ago about when we write, and, you know, I write first thing in the morning, and I can't look at my email, can't do anything. And I feel like it's that kind of the way you described it, Ishmael, that before consciousness moment when you're still half asleep, you're still able to tap into like image in particular, I think, which is before thought. It's the quality of thinking that we directly do that or memory, the idea that you maybe have or articulated or organized moments that come through that kind of writing.
does it all have to be, and if not, what effort it goes?
I think that the verse that actually doesn't have a poetry in it. I think it can rhyme. It can do very well with rhyming. And the first that comes to my mind is Geoffrey Allen Argent's translation of Jean Racine. He's recently coming out with all of his plays. That is such intensity and fire and emotional life to it. And it's translated in the Alexandrian into English couplets. And so I think most poetry actually doesn't rhyme or doesn't necessarily need a defined versified form. And what makes it poetry is that, you know, that life and vitality that I think we all, if we allow ourselves to take it in, we all can experience. It can be a universal effect.
I would say poems don't have to rhyme, but I think that there's a strong musicality aspect to poetry. And I think it can come in so many different ways. I notice, like, in Ishmael's most recent book, you use a lot of repetition, and it kind of has that almost oral tradition quality to it. And I feel like it has a lot of musicality without directly rhyming. And I think the notion of it has to rhyme, I think, is something that comes often from childhood poems or from maybe poetry of the last century. But there's so many ways to get musicality in a poem without the strictures of it has to be ABAB, which I think can be sometimes limiting or distracting. And I would rather see the music arise directly from the subject matter and be organic to the poem rather than a form that the poem is fighting, which I think can sometimes happen.
How have poems changed over the years?
Well, I think poems before most of human history have been in the oral tradition, you know, and so a lot of the poetry that we got was not necessarily even called poetry, but it was in the oratory of a Tlingit elder. Having these metaphors that are just, they pop like the greatest thing you've ever read anywhere. Or in the stories, that those stories, even if they're not in, you know, like the Homeric tradition, that or some kind of meter to it, they can still have that deep, deep poetry to it. So I think that's the main change that I look at. I don't necessarily look from decade to decade. This is like most of human history.
One thing that I think to look at more recently that's interesting is I think we went through, poetry used to be very formal verse, right? So very sort of strict guidelines. And for most of the last century, free verse has reigned. And I think it's interesting to see more forms of formality coming back. We're seeing more and more journals interested in formal verse and things like sestinas, villanelles, tritinas. And I think a sense of formality is interesting, and it's changing a little bit the way that poets are beginning to appreciate that kind of structure on poetry.
As poets, do you try to write a poem every day?
I wish. I do try to write every day. I get up every morning at 4 and write. I teach, of course, so usually about mid-semester I get overwhelmed with papers and lose it. But my goal is to try to write every day. But I don't always write a poem. Sometimes it's just reading poems, putting down a line, something like that.
I think when a poem finds me, that I have that opportunity to, you know, you need some relaxing time and to have the deep and intense thought come to you, and that experience where you're just propelled into the poem. And so I kind of wait for that. I tried to write a poem every day, you know, coming up with much of the material for my book. But recently now it's more like maybe I'm lucky if it's once a month, you know, but it feels amazing to have a poem come out that, you know, you don't necessarily judge its quality of how good or bad it is, but where you feel like you're expressing the thing that you intended.
How do you know when it's done? And talk to me about the editing process.
It unfolds for me. Emily talked about musicality. So it's like just like a poem by Dufu or Levi, where it's almost like it's unfolding, and then it comes to it gently lands. You know, and that's like the oratory of Tlingit elders, too. So I relate to that kind of internalized form. And to me, it comes out. Maybe it has that repetition. And then it finally, intuitively, you know, I feel like it's gotten to a certain place. And I don't feel like I'm writing all of it. I feel like I'm just waiting for something to come to me. And then maybe I alter it a little bit and change it. But it's to me, it's best when it's like Allen Ginsberg said, first thought, best thought.
It depends on the poem for me. Most poems, I would say, for me, probably go through 12 to 20 drafts. Every once in a while, I get a poem, as my old poetry teacher, Iris Adolf, would say, that drops straight from heaven into your lap, and it doesn't go with much revision. I think I know it's done when I find myself putting in and taking back out a comma. You know, I've gotten to that stage where I've done kind of the major structural revisions. It's saying what I wanted to say. It's starting to get some lift. Basically, I think of poems as starting to take flight. It's working. And then I'm messing with syntax a little, and I think, okay, it's pretty close. Although, every time I do a reading, you know, every once in a while I'm like, ooh, I'm going to take that line out, even though it's in the book, you know. I still want to tweak it just a little bit sometimes, even, you know, months or years later.
Both poets have several books out. I was wondering if you could read a little bit of your poems.
Sure. You want to go first?
And tell me a little bit about the poem, which we should be looking for, a map to your poem.
Okay, this poem is for my lovely wife, Lily. I don't know, she's probably laying down with our baby, but I wanted to read it. I hope someday that you will find me and I will find you. And by then, I may let go of hope and of naming things, let go of work, let go of you, let go of our child. In the meantime, I'll try not to promise much and ask for less, and eat your meals like Betty feeds on your motherhood. The onion skin of your sadness and the offenses heaped on you will be scribbled on and wept upon and wrinkled and crumpled by me every day that I watch you study and cook and sing. It's perfectly clear that when we die, as when we're born, that the limbs of our bodies, the eyes and ears and mouth and nose and fingers will resonate with the face and the marrow of things. And in between, we'll walk along our grandfather's caressing spirit, the one we'll become when we're gone.
And Ishmael Hope reading from, the name of that book is?
Courtesans of Flounder Hill. It just came out by Ishmael Reed Publications, who my parent, they were close with Ishmael Reed. He's a prominent writer in the Bay Area. And him and his wife, Carla, put the book out.
Emily?
Yeah, I'll read the last poem from my book. This is called Leaving the Islands. In terms of maybe what to listen for, I use repetition in this poem, some anaphora, a little bit. And it's stanzas of triplets and then one line at the end. And one of my favorite poets is James Wright. And I feel like one of my goals of poetry is always, can I do a turn at the end? Can I take it somewhere a little bit different? I don't know if this poem does it, but it's trying. Leaving the islands. I want to slice thin layers of skin and leave them here on Galliano, drying on rocks in Montague Harbor. I want to take the peeled bark from an arbutus on Thetis Island, weave it between my fingers, make sea stars. I want to drink salt water, turn my hair into a new species of kelp. I want to float between trees over the forest floor, smelling cedar, 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 listening to woodpeckers, gray jays, one owl swimming in air. I want never to move out of my body.
The name of that book is?
And this is Liveaboard, which you can get at Kindred Post or Hearthside Books.
And Ishmael, where can people get the copies of your book?
Kindred Post and Hearthside Books as well. Yeah, we have amazing supporters in town. It's just really neat how the extra mile that the businesses go to support our local authors.
Yeah.
Ishmael Hope and Emily Wall, thank you very much for coming down to the station.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 24th of June, 2015. It's the birthday of Ambrose Bierce, born near Horse Cave Creek, Ohio, 1842, well known for his short stories, particularly An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, and also for The Devil's Dictionary. He was in the Union Army in the Civil War. He fought in some of the bloodiest battles, later wrote stories about the war, bleak, bitter stories with senseless deaths and no heroes. It was on this day in 1374 in Aachen, Germany, the first recorded outbreak of dancing plague or dancing mania, also known as St. Vitus's Dance, began. Thousands of people at a time dancing uncontrollably, days, weeks, even months, until they collapsed from exhaustion. Some danced themselves to death. At the time, people believed it was the result of a curse from St. Vitus, and now scientists tend to believe it was simply mass hysteria. It's the birthday of the poet John Ciardi, born in Little Italy, Boston's North End, 1916, author of many collections of poetry, and also the textbook How Does a Poem Mean?, still widely used in high schools. And it's the birthday of the novelist Anita Desai, born in Mussoorie, India, 1937, her mother German, her father Bengali. She grew up speaking German at home, Hindi with her friends, learned Bengali from her father, listened to Urdu poetry in the street, and learned to read and write in school in the English language. Author of 12 novels, all in English, Clear Light of Day, In Custody, Fasting, Feasting, three of them. And it's the birthday of the poet Stephen Dunn, born Forest Hills, New York, 1939, published more than 10 books of poetry before his collection Different Hours won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001. His first love was basketball. He was a star on the Hofstra basketball team of 1962. They went 25-1 on the year, played pro basketball for a couple of years after that. He was a brochure writer for Nabisco for 7 years and then quit, moved to Spain with his wife, and started to write poetry. Here's a poem by Stephen Dunn on his birthday entitled Sweetness. Just when it has seemed I couldn't bear one more friend waking with a tumor, one more maniac with a perfect reason, often a sweetness has come and changed nothing in the world except the way I stumbled through it for a while, lost in the ignorance of loving someone or something. The world shrunk to mouth size, hand size, and never seeming small. I acknowledge there is no sweetness that doesn't leave a stain, no sweetness that's ever sufficiently sweet. Tonight, a friend called to say his lover was killed in a car he was driving. His voice was low and guttural. He repeated what he needed to repeat, and I repeated the one or two words we have for such grief, until we were speaking only in tones. Often a sweetness comes, as if on loan, stays just long enough to make sense of what it means to be alive, then returns to its dark source. As for me, I don't care where it's been or what bitter road it's traveled to come so far, to taste so good. Sweetness, a poem by Stephen Dunn from his new and selected poems published by Norton and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by Progressive Insurance with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Minutes past the hour, you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. Next guests are Tim Ortiz and Andrea Donahue, both artists at the Canvas Community Art Studio. Here is an update on various activities coming up here in the near future. Welcome to the station, everybody.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for having us.
So, what's going on at the Canvas? Would it be the Saturday critique that's coming up first?
The critique and drawing sessions have been going on for a few weeks. They're every Saturday. You don't have to sign up for anything for that at all. That's just a regular thing we do every Saturday. From 10 to noon, we have a drawing session. Drop-in drawing session. You have to sign up. It's just $20. and then a critique, which follows that. We encourage local artists to bring in whatever they're working on, to discuss it with other local artists, and that part is free. That's from 12 to 1 o'clock.
What do you teach people when they're receiving a critique and they're not happy with it?
Well, our critiques are very productive. We've been doing them with the Reach artists at the Canvas over the past several months, and it's a really important thing to do. The criticism that we offer, we're both art writers. It's intended to be productive and constructive. This is not a scary or a negative thing.
Right. It's important, I feel, to receive feedback about your work and how others are perceiving your work, so you can gauge whether you're being successful in what you're trying to convey. And then we both have a broad knowledge of art history and contemporary art, so we can recommend other artists who are working similarly, so people can refer to those other artists and know what else is going on in their chosen medium.
Yeah, that's an important point. It's not about making judgments about what is good or bad in terms of what people are trying to do with their art. It's trying to understand what the artist's intentions are and how they're going about achieving those intentions, and whether that's successful or not, and if it's not, how can it become successful.
What other classes are coming up in the near future?
Well, the thing we're here to promote, actually, is the youth classes at the Canvas, the summer youth classes. We both are teaching some coming up pretty soon. I'm doing a watercolor class for kids. That's July 6th to the 10th, and then there'll be another session from the 13th to the 17th in watercolor painting. And then Andriana.
I'll be teaching a paper mache class, and those sessions are July 20th to the 24th, 1 to 4 p.m., and July 27th to 31st, also from 1 to 4 p.m., and those are for kids ages 8 and up.
When did you first discover that you're an artist?
Well, for me, it's just something that I've always done since I was a kid, and I discovered it was something I was good at, technically, so I continued to make art, but over time, it became more of a way of navigating the world and using it as a way to exercise creative problem solving and think about certain ideas and sort of work those out for myself.
Yeah, and I've always, my mother's an art teacher, so being creative has always been encouraged in my life, and so it's always been something that's important to me, is have some sort of creative outlet, especially in painting and drawing. So in college is when I started to pursue it very seriously, but it's always been something that I've done.
What impresses you about the Canvas?
The Canvas is fantastic. They're a great studio for the local artists with developmental disabilities. This is something that we study, Andriana and I, and write about in our blog, disparateminds.org. It's the reason we came to Juno. So the community classes are offered allow the Canvas to be integrated with the community a bit more than other similar studios are around the country, which is something that impresses us. And something we've been participating in. So it's one of the reasons we're doing these classes for kids and for adults in the community.
A great public resource.
Yeah, yeah.
More classes you want to talk about?
The watercolor class I have coming up for kids, it should be a lot of fun. Like Andriana's, it's going to be from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock for ages 8 and up. It's a really great medium for kids, watercolor. It's non-toxic, it's easy to clean up, and it's very accessible. It has sort of a reputation for being unforgiving and difficult, watercolor, but it doesn't need to be. My approach to teaching, especially with kids, is all about sort of just guiding the natural creative impulse and encouraging kids to explore, their ideas and to think about them. And so challenging them with something like watercolor is really valuable to their development as artists and as people, I think.
Is there a moment when they get it?
Well, with kids, they're so fearless from the start, which is a really important thing to encourage. And so it's a really good time to get into something like watercolor that a lot of people get to be afraid of later in life.
And then for me, with paper mache, we'll start out with exercises that introduce ideas of designing and constructing three-dimensionally. But really, the emphasis will be on imagination and originality, so it should be a pretty fun class.
And watercolor class is when?
Watercolor class is July 6th to the 10th, from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., and then there's a second session the following week from the 13th to the 17th, same time.
I've been talking with Tim Ortiz and Andrea Donahue about the art classes at the Canvas. Anything you'd like to add?
That's it for us. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
It's not spoken or written, it's not something you taste, it's what you see. Art is lines and color and space. It can happen anytime, any place. From the caveman's painting such a long time ago, to the subway graffiti.
Past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. My name is Jeff Brown, your host for today. In the studio with me next are Jocelyn Ferrer and Connor O'Day, here to talk about Tai Chi for seniors offered by the Catholic Community Services. Thank you very much for coming down today.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
First of all, for people who may not have any idea what Tai Chi is, can you describe it, please?
Yes. So Tai Chi is essentially, it consists of the slow release body movements, focusing on both mind and body and for concentration. And so it's a slower pace It requires persistence with your practice and focus on each individual movement that the instructor is leading you along with, and essentially just trying to get that muscle memory down and while focusing on similar to a yoga with your breathing and the concentration of each individual movement.
Is it difficult or is it physically demanding?
The idea behind it is to not be physical demanding, actually. The movements are designed to really have the least amount of stress on your body as possible, so that way it can be for everybody. And so that way, depending on your physical abilities, there's offering of both seated movements and standing, depending on what your preference is and what your comfort level is. And so it's really for all abilities.
Any new instructor?
Yes, Jeff. My name is Jocelyn. I am an instructor for two series now. I'm on my third. It's ending July 2nd. So now we're promoting for the July 6th coming up, which is going to be taught by Glenn Ray, which is the second instructor for the Southeast Senior Services. Again, it's July 6th to August 28th for 8 weeks, Mondays and Thursdays from 9:45 a.m. to 10:45 a.m. at the Greening Park Community Room.
Tachi has been known to help arthritis and prevent falls. What other?
Well, the only thing that I'd like to add on to Connor's comment on the Tai Chi is that Tai Chi is definitely, in my personal belief, it's a Tai Chi for all season. You can do it in the wintertime. You can do it in the summertime. You can do it indoor, outdoor. It's also an inexpensive exercise because you don't need to buy expensive gears and equipment. All you need is your focus and your mind and your willingness to do the Tai Chi. So I believe a lot of our participants in the past have benefited from it. I've heard a lot of our participants say that they have ongoing knee problem, and ever since they've taken the Tai Chi, they have developed more balance, flexibility. In fact, many of their doctors recommend Tai Chi and very impressed and happy to hear that their patients are taking some of our Tai Chi class. So,
what do you attribute its success to?
I'm sorry?
What do you attribute its success to?
I think mainly that what I would attribute it to is the instruction itself. Our instructors, so we have Glenn Ray and Josie Lind, are both certified by the evidence-based, by Dr. Lamb is his name, and he's developed the classes, and it's his teachings that have gone through the rigorous studies of, is this legitimate? Does this actually prevent falls? Does this help with arthritis? And the findings have been yes. And so what people have done is they've taken his teachings and they've developed a criteria based around that. And our instructors have gone to those teachings and had to go through a number of series of classes to become certified, and then actually have had to be tested on the movements themselves and to be making sure that our instructors do know how to properly go through the movements. And so what I would attribute it to is kind of that making sure that we are taking the proper steps to teach people properly. And the movements that people are seeing in going along with are the movements that have been proven through studies to show preventative maintenance on, as Josie Lind kind of referred to, of fall prevention, one's improving one's flexibility, improving one's confidence in their ability to to get out of bed in the morning, to lift themselves up, and to really become in tune with their body and their movements and the importance of how moving in a certain ways can really help you without straining your body. So,
what should people wear?
Really casual, comfortable, loose helps, I think. And, I would say a good pair of shoes, good pair of tennis shoes, or it can be done barefoot if people are comfortable with that. But I would say, you want a solid platform. So I would avoid the loose flip flops or clogs or something like that, where something supportive.
Is there a fee for the class?
No.
Yeah, this class is comes through grants through the Department of Health and Social Services, which allows us to offer this free Tai Chi to seniors over the age of 60. That is the one qualification, but it's free to anyone and open to anybody. So registration is going on now for the class. As Josie Lynn said, it does start July 6th. It will run through August 28th. That's Mondays and Thursdays, 9:45 to 10:45 at Gruning Hall. And in order to register, you call Josie Lynn at 463-6177.
Or 463-6181. So two numbers that they can call.
Josie Lynn, you've taught it for at least a couple of years.
Yes, a couple of series. So I'm completing my first year of teaching Tai Chi, so I taught 3 Tai Chi classes.
What goes through your mind when you're watching these people develop from just a beginner to someone who's more accomplished in it?
Well, it's definitely a good feeling for me as an instructor to see the benefit that our participants are getting and the fact that they come every day, twice a week when we have classes, and that their eagerness and looking forward to it. And I think a lot of the times, too, if it's not the exercise, it's definitely the socialization part of it that I think adds to wanting to learn Tai Chi, and it's kind of getting together with their friends, because they do develop friendship in the 8 weeks that we teach it. So it's a good feeling, definitely, when at the end of the 8 weeks we hear, how the exercise benefited them. It's the testimonial per se that I hang on to, and I kind of very proud of, because I contributed to that.
It's happening. What dates again, please?
Well, the one that's coming up, Jeff, is July 6th to August 28th, 9:45 to 10:45, Mondays and Thursdays at the Greening Park. And it's going to be taught by Glenn Ray. Again, it's Glenn Ray is the instructor for the one coming up. The next one, if anybody care to know the next schedule that I'll be teaching, is the August 31st to October 23rd, which is when I teach. But right now, we're definitely recruiting participants for the July 6th Tai Chi series.
And from my understanding, these classes fill up fairly rapidly.
It sure does. So we encourage everyone to please sign up. Call the Southeast Senior Services at 463-6181 or 6177 to reserve your spot.
All right, Connor O'Day and Jocelyn Ferrara, thank you very much for coming to the station today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
This is Bird Note. Northern mockingbirds, the continent's most proficient copycats, can learn to mimic the sounds of just about any other bird within earshot. But they mimic to show off, not to deceive. Males with the greatest repertoire are the first to attract mates. That's the payoff. If a mockingbird imitates a cardinal song, it's unlikely any cardinals are fooled in the process. No harm, no foul, no deceit intended. But a tiny songbird in South America called the thick-billed euphonia does employ what scientists call deceitful mimicry, a very rare trait among birds. When frightened by a predator near its nest, a thick-billed euphonia imitates the alarm calls of other birds nesting nearby. This stirs them into action, and they rush in to harass the predator, maybe chasing it off while leaving their own nests in peril. The euphonia, meanwhile, sits tight, maybe shouting out a few more bogus alarms while others do the dirty work. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
In the studio with me is Sven Pearson from the Juneau Douglas Capital City Fire and Rescue team. Sven, thank you very much for coming down the station.
Thank you, Jeff.
You're here to talk about fire safety during these especially dry months.
Yes, that's right. Right now, you know, across the state, we're seeing a lot of wildfires, and it's been years that it's been that, as bad as it is right now up north. In fact, today I was looking at it, and we've got over 280 active fires going on across the state, and about 31 of those are being staffed. Down here in Southeast, we're pretty lucky. We've been, you know, very fortunate, especially with the warm weather that we've had and the dry conditions. I was talking with our weather service folks, and they said relative humidity today was about 40%, and it would start raining tonight. And that, those are the things that we like. As much as we love the sunshine, we like to see a little bit of moisture and a little bit of humidity come in, because there's a lot of grasses out there and a lot of areas where, you know, having a little bit of summer fun, before you know it, some of the fire can get away from you.
What are some basic rules when you're doing campfires?
Well, campfires, you always want to make sure that you've got your fire on actual dirt or ground or gravel. You don't want to be putting a campfire maybe on like a grassy area, because it doesn't take long for, you know, a little bit of a breeze and the dry fuels in the grasses will start burning. So basically make sure you've got a clear area to have the campfire in. Also pay attention to the weather. If the wind starts kicking up, you know, those flames, if the flames get larger, they will gravitate over towards combustible areas as well. That's, you know, another thing is always make sure that if you are starting a campfire or anything like that, don't use fuel. Don't use the combustible liquids, you know, gasoline, diesel, those kind of things, because there's a lot of vapor in there, and that can actually bite you. So we say start with paper, work with kindling, start working up to a larger fuels, the logs and that.
What about barbecues?
Barbecues is one that, you know, same thing. Summertime, people love getting out the barbecues. Most of our barbecues are fired nowadays with propane. There's some guys that still like to do the coals, and that's fine. But with barbecues, you know, it doesn't take much. And if you've got a maybe like an enclosed deck, you have to remember about that overhead space. That'll get warm. It's easy for, you know, if you're not paying attention to it or you step away, you don't have the lid down, flames can shoot up with grease. You know, especially when you're doing things, let's say, like chicken wings, any of the fattier meats, you know, the grease starts dripping and you start getting, you know, some fairly large flames. We actually go to a number of fires that are the result of barbecues. And another big one is smokers, you know, people that like to smoke fish. We all love smoked salmon. You go out and you get smoked salmon, you put in those little smokers. The worst part about it, it's one of our, we call it the fire marshal's nightmare, is those little smokers, because, you know, they give you like a 6-foot cord. You look around and the only 6-foot cord is like right against the house. So you plug it into that, and you know, you try to keep it out of the rain and out of the, you know, the weather. And depending upon what you've got in there, it's not a good idea because it can burn through the deck. It can also burn up alongside if you have, you know, combustible siding and things like that. And as soon as it gets up into your soffits, it's got free rein in your attic. And that's a very difficult place for us to fight a fire.
What's the first thing someone should do if they suspect that they're going to have a problem?
If you think you're going to have a problem, call 911. We would rather go there and find out it's nothing, as you know, you just put it out, than have someone try to fight it and it gets out of hand. We've had those type of cases before where, you know, someone thinks, hey, I've got it under control. It's too embarrassing to call. I'll just run and get some water. I'll fill up the pot or I'll do this. Call 911. Get out of the house. Call 911. Oven fire, close the oven, keep it closed. Pan fire, grease fire, don't throw water on it. That's the quickest way to really get hurt. Put a lid on it, cover it up. I almost recommend have a fire extinguisher in your kitchen. It's a good place for it, for indoor, you know, cooking and that. And it's also a good thing to have a fire extinguisher that you can use out on your deck or, you know, easily accessible. Not back in the corner of the garage where, you know, last time you saw it was about 3 years ago. So it's good to, you know, stay attentive to that.
So you're probably talking about a fire extinguisher that is fully charged.
Exactly. Yeah. And just because the gauge says, you know, it's full or it's in the green doesn't always mean that's the case. We have seen extinguishers that have failed because, you know, over time pressure starts leaking out. You know, there might be a faulty valve or something. And it looks good, but, you know, it definitely needs to be serviced.
What percentage of fires, and I'm including wildfires in this as well as home fires, what percentage are preventable?
You know, a lot of the fires are preventable. It really is. And it can be anything from using common sense to, you know, and that comes down to, you know, make sure you're not reckless or careless. We've had grass fires that have started because of, you know, someone thought, okay, I'll just throw the cigarette out here and it's all fine and dandy. You know, take the extra step. And make sure that what you're doing is safe. There's a lot of fires that could have been prevented.
Now that I got you, I've got another question that has
sure.
Nothing to do with fires. sort of does. Sometimes we'll be sitting somewhere, and one fire truck goes by, and then an ambulance goes by.
Right.
Why? When?
You know, Jeff, you're not the first person to ask that question. That's a common question people ask. And why every time I see the fire truck and the ambulance go by? And a lot of that's because when the fire truck leaves, it's got two people on it. It's got the captain and it's got an engineer. The ambulance, it's got a paramedic on it and it has another medic that's driving. If it's a medical call, depending upon what the medical emergency is, a lot of times we don't know. You know, they might come in that someone has fallen down. We show up and we find out this is a cardiac issue. And if you're dealing with a heart attack, it takes a number of folks to manage that scene. So it's good to have that amount of people on scene there. There's other times that we'll respond to a scene and it might not be a big deal. Might be, you know, maybe someone has a little injury or something, not feeling well. But at the same time, we have another call that comes in. Well, we can break apart. We can send the fire truck to the other emergency, but we've got the resources there if we need them. And it makes a really big difference on a call. We wish we could have, you know, four guys on the engine and, you know, a couple folks on the ambulance, but times are tight. We don't have that, unfortunately.
You have a lot of great volunteers, though.
That's true. We have a number of folks that have volunteered. Past, present, and what's interesting too is among the volunteer ranks, we have kind of changed some of the stuff that we do. We're actually recruiting kids in the high schools through a cadet program. They might not be able to fight a fire, but at least we can give them some of the basic training for responding to emergencies. And after they've done that for a while, next thing you know is, hey, they've got their sights on, when I'm 18, I want to go through the Firefighter One program. I want to become an EMT. So it's a way to actually get some of the younger people engaged into the fire service at an earlier age. And hopefully they'll stick around. They'll be volunteers. And then at some point, hopefully they will join us as career firefighters.
So to wrap up, can you go over the top three things that people should be aware of this summer season?
Top three things. One thing is, so far we've had a wonderful, warm summer. I hope it continues, but be smart. Have a water source available or a way to extinguish a fire if you're going to have a campfire. If you're out barbecuing, make sure that you're attending to that barbecue, or even inside the home, that you're attending to your cooking. Don't leave cooking unattended. Those will be probably the top two things. And the three things, for the third thing, if you don't have a fire extinguisher, be sure to get one.
Sven Pearson, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
That should do it. I hope everybody has a happy Fourth of July.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Jeff.
My name is Bruce Van Dusen. I am the director at Polaris House. Every day I see people suffering with the health effects of tobacco use. Many will die of tobacco-related disease. My message as a behavioral health provider is this: smoking has no mental health benefits, and stopping smoking is therapeutic. Talk to a doctor or pharmacist about quitting tobacco, or call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. You can succeed.
Brought to you by the Partnership for a Tobacco-Free Southeast and Search.
Listening to Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, we'll continue our series Words 101 with a conversation on how to read with librarians Julie Niederhauser, Andy Hirsch, and MJ Grandy. We'll talk with Celia Jackson from the Red Cross about an upcoming class on disaster preparedness. James Hoagland from the 4A's will be here with details about Saturday's National HIV Testing Day. We'll talk with Clinton Singletary about the senior sales tax exemption cards. And we'll hear about what's happening in Juno with Nancy DeTourney during Arts Up. The forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain, low temperatures around 55 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, rain likely with high temperatures around 62 degrees. Friday, rain with high temperatures again around 60 degrees.